for members only. Golf Smarter number 460, published on October 28, 2014.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Mastering Golf's Mental Game with author Dr. Michael T. Lardon.
This is Golf Smarter.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Michael.
Hi, Fred.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Nice to be here, Fred.
It's great to have you back on the show. Your first book was many years ago, right?
2008 now. Hard to believe.
Wow. Well, congratulations. You've gone through a lot in that time. And professionally as well. But you have a new book, Mastering Golf's Mental Game, The Ultimate Guide to Better On-Course Performance and Lower Scores. Michael, I have a shelf full of mental game books. Why should I be getting rid of all of them to keep yours?
Well, I don't know about getting rid of them all, but, but this book is really designed to be a little bit different. And it's modeled next to a very famous book called Feeling Good by David Burns, which is a psychology book. And if you ever go to all the outpatient clinics, it's sort of a Bible. And the model is like this. That Feeling Good book is actually a workbook where you look at pieces of your mindset, and then you get to rate it, and then you get to reframe it. So if you get through the book, you end up, it's hard not to get better. Mm-hmm. And this book is really set up for you to interact with the book. It has drills. It has ways in which you can find out, I'm strong in motivation, but I'm weak in emotional control. And if that's the case, these are exercises to get you better. So it's really meant to be a hands-on book to help you improve.
Well, it's clear that that's the case because you have homework assignments, you have tests in it, which I found to be a lot of fun. And is that the format of the other book? Is it give you little assignments across the board?
Yeah, I mean, the famous Feeling Good book is like that. And really, this book comes from, you know, I get calls all the time to work with various players of various levels, and I don't have the time to do that. I can barely work with the tour players that I work with. And so at the university, I teach a curriculum for sports psychology, if you will. And really, this book is a compilation of the curriculum I teach the medical students and the residents who are interested in sports psychology.
I see. And where do you teach?
I'm at UCSD, the University of California, San Diego. Yeah, I'm a professor there.
Good science school, right?
Very good neuroscience, tremendous neuroscience place.
Well, that's good to know because I have a nephew who went there and majored in neuroscience.
Yeah, that's a great place.
Yeah, yeah. Now he's a professional musician.
Well, he's a smart guy.
He's the smartest drummer on the stage.
Yeah, of course.
So I'm going through because I dog-eared a whole lot of stuff in this book, I don't even know where to get started on picking apart which parts are so important. But again, this podcast is more about how do we get the average golfer better. So, let's just go there. Yeah,
sure. Sure. Well, here's the main thrust of it. And it's the same for the tour player as it is for the average golfer. And I really think it probably benefits the average golfer more. And what do I mean? I mean this. Everybody that plays sport, especially in golf, it's human nature to become result-oriented. Mm-hmm. I just need a par on the last hole to break 90 or break 80. Or you say to yourself, gosh, how did I make that triple bogey on the last hole? That leaks into the next hole, and you play poorly. So we have to accept that we are result-oriented people, human beings are. That's one piece. Now, if you read all the sports psychology books on your shelf, and mine's probably up there too, my old one, and what you hear the sports psychologists talk about very consistently is that the golfer or the athlete really has to focus on the process. Now, what do we mean by process? We mean, what are the components of hitting each shot? So I've come up with this term called pre-shot pyramid, which is very simple. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it kind of has three parts, and it goes like this. Every shot, you have to calculate, you know, if it's a putt, the brakes over here, the speed is such and such. If it's a driver, you know, I'm going to cut it off the left tree, or an iron, I need to hit it 155 yards. So you make some calculation, and in a very general way, we call that the left brain. If you don't make that calculation, you're probably not going to do well. But after that is a really important part. You make your calculation, and it's important you just don't go up and hit it. It's important that you use your right brain, and you either visualize the shot. That's like Aaron Baddeley. He sort of closes his eyes and sees the shot. Or you feel it kinesthetically. And what I mean by that is, let's say you're going to hit a draw or a hook. You sort of reverse. I mean, you rehearse, you know, your hands turning over. Conversely, if you're going to hit a slice, you would kind of maybe rehearse holding on. And if you look at the good players, David Duval, Tiger Woods, Phil, many of them, Phil has a lot of visual stuff, but many of them really, they have the feel of the shot. And then after that, ideally, you just step in and hit the shot with instinct. So we go left brain, think about it, right brain, feel it, step in and hit it. And those are the three components of the pre-shot pyramid for all shots. Now, why that's important, Fred, is because we ask the golfer to rate his process. And that means, let's say on the first hole, I hit a great drive right down the middle, but I didn't really take the time to decide where I wanted to hit it. I sort of got lucky, so I didn't go through the left brain part one. So even though I hit it 280 yards down the middle, I do not get a point for that shot because I didn't get through the process. Now, conversely, I might hit my second shot and I might, you know, think about it well, rehearse it and hit it, and I even could hit it out of bounds. But if I went through that process, I get a one for one. And so what we get is the golfer starts to pay attention to rating his process, and that satiates the human nature to sort of rate how you're doing. But what you've done is you've turned your attention to the right thing, which is, I don't want to worry about the double bogey behind me or the birdie I need. What I'm really focused on is just doing these components that lead to a good shot. So we sort of trick the golfer into being process-oriented while he's rating himself. And that's sort of the trick of it. And let's say you shoot 100 that day, then you look back and you say, of those 100 shots, well, 60 of them, I really did my pre-shot pyramid, so you'd get a 60% that day. And what we found is the average golfer is around 50 to 60%, where the tour players are in the 90 percentile range. And if we can help you, you know, stay on task with a few more shots, you're going to end up scoring a lot better.
You'll get higher scores on your pyramid and lower scores on your card.
Exactly. That's exactly right, Fred. So that's kind of the trick, the big overarching principle.
And you have various components to your pre-shot pyramid. It's not just the planning and the concentration. It starts low. I really like the idea of it had attitude, motivation, control, optimization, concentration, and then planning. Why that order?
Well, I mean, we start with, you know, things like, you know, do you have the right attitude? And really that chapter, it's derived from a woman, Carol Dweck at Stanford, who's a very famous psychologist. And she has articulated a concept called mindset. And over 35 years, she studied successful people in sport, art, politics, and she studied people who were not. And what she has found, and she's published academic papers in addition to a popular book called Mindset, is that successful people, they view an obstacle as a challenge. They take criticism as something that they can learn from, and they see other people's success as inspiring, where people with a fixed mindset, not a flexible mindset, they see obstacles as intimidating or other people's success as intimidating. And so in that chapter in particular, we teach you that concept, the mindset of very successful people and then those who are not. And then we ask you to rate yourself And we're find out where you are on that continuum. And then we actually give questions and drills to help you move to a more flexible mindset, a more adaptive mindset. And that's kind of chapter one that sort of sets the stage. You know, then we talk about motivation. Why do you play? And if your motivation decreases, sort of getting connected with falling in love with the game. And we call that internal motivation. And so we give you concepts. And again, we go through what I think are the really important things, which are, you know, what's your attitude? How do you stay motivated? Then how do you deal with emotion, positive and negative? If we make a double eagle, we want to be, you know, a little fist pump, but be relatively cool because we have a hole after that. Or you have, you know, negative thoughts, don't hit it in the water. And we look at, you know, when those thoughts come up, these are techniques to turn your attention to what is going to be best for you rather than let your mind drift there. And then we talk about, you know, how to put this whole thing together in a cohesive plan. When we talked about the mental scorecard a minute ago, that's really the application on the course, where the first part of the book that we're talking about now, that sort of sets the ground stage for, you know, the components that very good athletes and very good golfers need to have to perform well.
I'm fascinated about the motivation part. I'm sure that you have discovered a wide range of answers on motivation going from amateurs to tour players. But I'm curious about amateurs and recreational players, what you hear, what's the vast difference of motivations they have to play golf?
Well, it's a great question. And if your motivation is, you know, to smoke cigars with your buddies and have a cocktail at the turn, if that's your motivation, just to fraternize and have fun, well, that's one thing, and you probably aren't buying this book because you're less concerned about scoring well. Yeah. But let's say your motivation...
I think those guys are more concerned about scoring well with the cart girl, but that's a whole different conversation.
Yeah, that one I don't have the expertise in.
I don't even want to go there. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But maybe when I, before I was married younger, 3 kids ago. Yeah, but anyhow. Right. The average guy, you know, they generally play golf because they love it. It's a lot of fun. And then what happens is, you know, they get in the Saturday morning games with their buddies and they start to, you know, compare themselves to their buddy. And their motivation changes from really enjoying the game, making good shots, to, you know, how do I stack up against my friends? And it takes a lot of the fun out of it sometimes if their mindset, if you will, in competition is unhealthy. So what we try to do is we try to identify if your motivation stays pure, which is, you know, I play for the joy of it and I love concentrating and competing. That's healthy. Versus, you know, you start to get scared and intimidated and then you start to, let's say, at negative cognition, which is a fancy way of saying negative thought, which is, you know, I'm not a bad putter. Well, or I can't putt. You know, words like can't aren't words sports psychologists or sports psychiatrists like myself use. So we really kind of take a look and we try to reconnect you with enjoying the game. And then we build some armor around you to deal in the competitive environment so you can still have fun and concentrate on what's important, which is having fun.
The motivation for somebody who, and like for myself, my motivation, I want to get better, right? I want to get better at golf. I want to improve. Is that a motivation that could become a problem?
Well, no, that's great. I mean,
that's results oriented, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, the goal is you want to improve. So then I'd say, well, what does that mean? And you'd say, well, I want to break 80. And I'd say, okay, that's a result goal. Okay. What is the process to break 80? Well, the process to break 80 is, you know, make a lot of pars and a few bogeys and maybe throw in a birdie. And then I'd say, well, how do you do that? And it will always distill down to, well, I have to hit quality shots. And so that's the process goal, is to hit better quality shots. And that's where we come back to the pre-shot pyramid. Now, let's say your problem is in the short game. We'd obviously spend more focus over there, but we still use that pre-shot pyramid as a process goal. And then over here, we have the result goal of improving the short game. And the overarching result goal would be to break 80. So there's actually in the goal setting chapter, I think that's under planning, we use a matrix where we ask you to define what's your result goal. And then we ask you to define, well, how are you going to get there? And that's the process. And so we actually keep tally of both things. So you make sure you have a good, healthy balance.
Passion seems to be a huge motivation for a lot of golfers.
Well, and that's the beauty of the average golfer, because passion, they play, most average golfers play with this, what we call internal motivation. And I use an analogy of premium gas versus low octane. So premium gas would be, yeah, I play for the love of it. Low octane gas would be, gosh, I need to make the cut to pay the rent this week. So the tour players, they actually paradoxically have at times more problems with motivation because they get burned out, and then their golf, you know, they don't just play for fun like we do. They have to do golf outings, and there's a business aspect, and that can sort of burn them out. And we see that all the time. And then we try to reconnect them with their youth when they played golf and they had fun. Because if you're not having fun, it's very hard to play well.
There is a great example in the book of a young phenom who comes up and hits the tour while he's still in high school. Why don't you share that story about how his motivation was, it seemed like it was derailed.
Yeah, now we're talking about Ty Tryon, who really is a heck of a good kid. And I think he's almost 30 now. But when he was, I think, 16, right, or 17?
I think you said 17 in the book, yeah.
17. He actually earned a fully exempt card on the PGA Tour, which I think to this date is the youngest player. My brother, I was caddying for my brother, ironically, behind him, and we watched him get his card. And that year, my brother also got his card. But the next year, Ty came to visit me. And, you know, he was a junior in high school or maybe a senior at that time. And you know, it was very tough because, you know, he wanted to have fun like normal high school kids. But the next thing you know, he had contracts with Nike. IMG was his agency, and Red Bull. And he had all these corporate responsibilities. So now you take a high school kid who really just wants to have some fun and loves golf, and you put him on a private jet, and he flew around with Tiger a lot, and that was big business. And I think that would be, you know, very hard at 17 years old to go through that process, and it made golf less fun. I mean, we've heard about Michelle Wee talking about those kinds of things in the media, and, you know, now she's playing great and won a U.S. Open. But she also talks about how she's reconnected, you know, to the passion of golf. And she's another example of a very young phenom who, when she had to deal with everything that comes with being a phenom, that sort of derailed a lot of her passion. We saw that with Rory McIlroy. You know, he wins his major, you know, he blows the Masters, but then he comes and wins his major and becomes, you know, this phenom. And then he has a dip in the level of his game because he has to integrate, you know, being under the microscope of the media and all this other stuff. And it probably wasn't that fun. I mean, people think, oh, gosh, it'd be super fun to be famous. I think like Andy Warhol in reverse, maybe for 5 minutes, it's super fun. But but after a while, it's pretty tiring not to be able to be a normal person. And that's a tough challenge for many of the high-profile athletes. So, you know, how do we reconnect them with the reason they fell in love with golf? That's really the goal, and keep that connection strong.
Now, I thought Rory fell apart because he went to different clubs, the Nikes. Never mind. So he got
well, there's more than that to conjecture, but certainly that was part of it.
Yeah.
You know, breaking up with a girlfriend and being under the spotlight of the media. And I think there were a lot of things that were a lot of new challenges. And if Rory didn't play well, I'm sure Nike wouldn't have come to him, you know, with a very lucrative contract. So that's all part and parcel.
And I frequently am asking questions about these young phenoms that are coming up and if they can, you know, because golf is so mental. And even on the tour, it's got to be so mental, especially the stress of a Sunday, that how can these kids handle this kind of pressure and still, you know, it's not just hitting the ball farther than everybody.
Well, I mean, you know, they, you know, it's a little like training Navy SEALs. You know, the really good ones really learn to, you know, how to deal with that pressure and get a playbook, if you will. And I liken my book to that. You know, it really has answers and suggestions. You know, we go out and play golf, and you know, number 16 at my course has a lot of water on the left, and you know, 90% of the people up there are aiming to the right and having really struggling. Very few of them, you know what an anchor thought is and ways to deal with our human nature when our mind drifts. So recently, I had a Web.com player, Camilio Benedetto, really a fine player, come visit with me. And, you know, he, like many players, you know, had good concentration, but really didn't have kind of a playbook. So in certain situations, you know, on the 17th or 18th hole, you know, to make a cut or win an event, you know, what do I do when these thoughts come up? So I think at almost every level, you know, we know a lot about the golf swing. Most players know how to do that, but most players don't know how to think in certain situations. And that's one of the main goals of the book, to really teach some of those pearls.
Michael's book, Mastering Golf's Mental Game, Your Ultimate Guide to Better On-Course Performance and Lower Scores, is available via Amazon as a hardback, a Kindle version, even as an audiobook download and audio CD. They're all available in the book section of Our Golfer's Mart at golfsmarter.com. Okay, this is it. This is the last time I'm going to remind you that Golf Smarter members receive an additional 10% discount for the game Golf when you use the checkout code GOLFSMARTER. This offer absolutely expires on November 1st, but if you're listening to this after the deadline, I want you to seriously consider picking up a game Golf to focus on the parts of your game that you struggle with the most. For me, it was short game, up and downs, and scrambling with pars. I didn't know that that was what I was struggling with until I saw the data coming back. So, here's a good one. Let me share an email that I got from longtime Golf Smarter member Dwayne Dusky. He said, I would love to join in the group with Game Golf, but I just can't see how it's better than my swing by swing app on my phone that tracks all of that, plus gives me GPS distances. Please clarify the benefits. Okay, Dwayne, here's what you get. Those apps, yes, those apps are great. I believe there are things about Game Golf that do truly separate them from the $5 and $10 apps. Game Golf doesn't impact your pace of play. There's no need to stop and study it during the round, especially if you're trying to look at your phone outdoors, not always the easiest thing. And like a podcast, the content that you get from Game Golf is content on demand. It's gathering data while you play. And then when you're ready to sit down and study it and look at it, it's there for you. Did you know that Game Golf is legal for tournament use? That's probably why both the PGA of America and the Golf Channel have invested in this product. I got to tell you a lot. But to me, that's nice. But most importantly, even though all the apps that we've been talking about use GPS, what sets Game Golf apart is that it's the only tool that I know of that provides you with ongoing data on the distances you hit each club. We've heard hundreds of times how most amateurs don't actually hit the ball as far as they think they do. It's true when you start looking at these things and realize that you don't hit your 7-iron 160 yards. With this info, you're going to learn the average distance, not the longest you can hit it when you hit it pure. Yeah, how many times that happened? But the average distance for each club. That point alone is what I believe is the single greatest factor that has dropped my index from 13.5 to 9.8 since I started using Game Golf this season. So get one today. Or maybe you should start dropping hints that this is the only golf gift you would like this holiday season. either way, to find out more or make your order online, click on the Game Golf ad on our homepage at golfsmarter.com. Please don't go to their website first. Click on the ad. It makes a huge difference for me and for them to see that you're coming from us. Up next, we're going to pick up the conversation right where we left off. One of the players that Michael has helped a lot is this guy named Phil. He keeps referring to Phil. Yeah, Mickelson. That story and more on the next Members Only episode. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.